may start by drinking this. It's not whiskey or vodka. That I assure you. It's just water. Today I'm getting into detail with respect to Great Zimbabwe, mainly presenting to you the archaeological picture. But before I get into detail, it was good having a chat with some of you yesterday. And in the process, I got one or two questions, which I would start by answering before I get into the thick of today's lecture. The question was, is there a relationship between Great Zimbabwe and Kami, which is located in southwestern Zimbabwe, approximately 22 kilometers away from the modern town of Bulawayo. This is the World Heritage Site of Kami. Don't believe everything that you see. If some of you have been to Kami perhaps before 2000, this was not there. This is a result of a reconstruction which was sponsored by UNESCO starting from the year 2000. So the answer is, there is a relationship between Great Zimbabwe and Kami. Of course, there are differences in that most of Great Zimbabwe's walls are freestanding walls as depicted on the Great Enclosure here, whereas Kami is terrace walls for building platforms. So most of the houses were erected on top of these platforms, but the designs and decorations, they are the same. So the conventional archaeological understanding of the Zimbabwe culture period, which encompasses Mapungubwe here, and then Great Zimbabwe and Kami, is that the development started at Mapungubwe, which is basically a flat-top sandstone hill near the confluence of Shashi and Lebobo River in Lebobo province. So Mapungubwe was occupied between 1840 and 1290, and then due to collapse linked to a variety of factors, the environment being one of them, it is alleged that Great Zimbabwe took over from 1800 to about 1450. We are not agreed on that. And then when Great Zimbabwe folded, Kami took over from around about that time to 1820, 1830. So Kami is an extension of Great Zimbabwe, which is also believed to be an extension of Mapungubwe. So in my discussion today, where possible, I'll try to make some connections between these three places. Back in the 1960s, 1970s, before improvements in radiocarbon dating, it used to be believed that because of its size, 720 hectares, it used to be believed that Great Zimbabwe was the originator of Mapungubwe and Kami. But there were some revisions that were conducted in the early 1980s. And as a result of that, the current understanding is that Mapungubwe is the first Zimbabwe culture capital. You may not see them, but believe me, there are stone walls on this mountain here. If you go to Mapungubwe, you may also not see them because they were covered by the conservators. But the take-home message is that Great Zimbabwe occupy an intermediate position as far as the development of what is known as the Zimbabwe culture is concerned. This is just a map to illustrate what I was saying and to give us an idea of the spatial relationship between all these places. So this is Mapungubwe here, where we are seeing all those flags on TV, and Great Zimbabwe, and then there is Kami. So this whole area, extending into Botswana here, is what I referred to yesterday as the landscape of the Lepidoscopy people. And not surprisingly, we have all these different places that emerged. It's just that as a result of poor research coverage, some of them we don't know them in as much detail as we should. This is just another map, just to present to us the fact that there are so many dry stone walled ruins which were built without any binding mortar using the precise placement method. You can see even in the vicinity of Great Zimbabwe here, there are so many Majiri and all these add-ons. I don't think that these smaller ones have received as much archaeological attention as they should receive. So, our understanding of the archaeology of Great Zimbabwe and all our interpretations of this ancient town are based on the archaeological work that was carried out by Keith Robinson, Roger Summers, and an architect known as Andrew Luigi. They started their work in 1958. The aim was to generate data and information which would enable them to understand the chronological development of Great Zimbabwe. Let's not forget that before then, in 1930, Gertrude Stephen Thompson had failed to resolve the issue of origins. Although her evidence pointed that Great Zimbabwe was local in origin, there were some people who were still doubting. They were saying that we want absolute dates. So what Keith Robinson and Roger Summers then did was to initiate a large-scale archaeological project which focused on multiple strands of evidence. And they divided Great Zimbabwe into three sections. The Hill Complex, that's where Keith Robinson worked, and then the Great Enclosure, that's where Roger Summers excavated. And he was also assisted there by an architect known as Andoni Witty. I'm going to show you the classification which was developed by Andoni Witty, and it is still very useful to this day. So after digging at Great Zimbabwe between 1958 and 1960, Keith Robinson and Roger Summers, they encountered a significant amount of archaeological deposit. And based on the law of stratification, which basically says that the deposit which is on top is older than the one at the bottom, they were able to order the age, or they were able to order the material culture which they were finding in those deposits. So this explains this scheme that we have. Based on the information from the Hill Complex, there, Keith Robinson found an area which had escaped the attentions of the treasure hunters of the late 19th and early 20th century. So he dug to about 4 meters deep, and at the base of that trench, he found a material which he labeled period one. So that is the first occupation of Great Zimbabwe by people who were practicing a typical Iron Age way of life. By Iron Age, I mean practicing crop farming as well as the keeping of small stock and cattle, and also working metal. These people, they are unrelated to the people who are built at Great Zimbabwe. It's just that they have their remains on top of the Hill Complex at Great Zimbabwe. In the archaeological sequence, there was also a break in occupation to round about AD 800. That's where Kim Robinson has defined what he calls period 1B. And this is also an early Iron Age occupation, except that the ceramics are different from those in period one. The next, in terms of the settlement history, was what Robinson called period two. And that's between AD 1050 to AD 1100. Some of you may be wondering, where did Robinson and Summers get these dates from? Radiocarbon dating had been invented then. It was invented by Willard Libby at Chicago in 1949. In the process, he won a Nobel Prize for that. So Keith Robinson and Roger Summers, they managed to use the technique of radiocarbon dating. So they dated charcoal from deposits associated with this early Iron Age material, and then came up with this time bracket. So period 2, AD 1050 to AD 1100, that's mainly associated with laparoscopy people, the ancestors of the modern Shona people. Karanga is a dialect of Shona. So these are Shona ancestral Shona speakers. And as you can see, that's the interface of the end of the first millennium AD and at the beginning of the second millennium AD. That's the period that is also associated with a long distance trade. We see a lot of exotic goods such as glass beads filtering into Great Zimbabwe at this point in time. If we are to go to the Shashi Limpopo around this time, we see that there was extensive occupation at that place, which is known as K2. Imports at K2 and those at Great Zimbabwe at this point in time, they are identical. And also in terms of geochemistry, they are the same, suggesting that perhaps they were manufactured in a single producer region. After period 2 came period 3, which is associated with Karanga speakers, and that's from around about AD 1100 to 1250. There is some disagreement, particularly among archaeologists. For example, when did a stone wall construction start at Great Zimbabwe? The evidence from Keith Robinson suggests that stone wall construction started during this period, but that is heavily disputed by researchers such as Tom Huffman, who think that stone wall construction started in a period 4. If you want my personal opinion, I think I am in between. What happens is that even these laparoscopic people, they were also constructing stone walls. So there's no reason why stone wall construction could not have started in period 3. It's just that being that complex maze of stone walls that Great Zimbabwe is, it is very difficult to find what we may call the first or the earliest stone wall at the site. Mindful of the fact that all those stone walls were built and rebuilt over time, David Collett excavated the valley enclosures, and he realized that the foundations of those stone walls had been moved from time to time, perhaps depending on the needs of the inhabitants at any given point in time. So that complicates our understanding of when these dry stone walls were built first. As I said, there is evidence of dry stone wall construction, particularly amongst the laparoscopy people before period 3 at Great Zimbabwe. So it might be an indicator of the fact that by then, Great Zimbabwe, the stone walls had already been built. Period 4 is associated with the flourishing of Great Zimbabwe. So all those are impressive stone walls, such as the Great Enclosure, they are believed to have been made during this period. Some archaeologists excavated part of the valley enclosures, what are known as the Renders ruins, and they found large quantities of glass beads and pieces of coral, some iron wire, and some silver spoons, items which have been interpreted as belonging to a merchant from the Indian Ocean coast. They said that it was a meeting point of locally produced material as well as exotic material, such that perhaps they were in the possession of a trader. The reason why I'm bringing up that interpretation is that during period 4, that's when we see Great Zimbabwe at the height of its power, even in terms of interactions That's also the time when we see that Arab coin from Kirua being found at Great Zimbabwe. After about 1550, period 5 ensued, and this is poorly understood. Remember yesterday I said that the top deposits were all removed by the Shelly excavators, and they have not been recorded. So we don't know what happened after 1550, but what we know is that when Karl Malk visited Great Zimbabwe in 1871, they were the local Mugabe people. They are not related to the president of the country. They were actually occupying some of the enclosures. There is one photograph which showed them having constructed some huts in the western enclosure at the hill complex. So that's a point of contention, whether Great Zimbabwe was continuously occupied over time or whether there was a break in occupation. But most archaeologists just end at AD 1550 and are less concerned with what happened after that. We know that Great Zimbabwe continued to be a ceremonial center. People went there for rain-making consultation and other rituals. And just to sum up, this sequence is based on pottery typology. Pottery typology, in simple terms, is basically ordering ceramics on the or pots on the basis of likeness in terms of decoration. So if any two pots have designs which are similar, then they belong to one time. And then you can order that through time, particularly using the stratification for these deposits. And you can come up with what is earlier and what is later. They also use the stratigraphic details, which is just a principle from geology, in as far as the natural strata is found in nature. The deposits at the bottom, they were deposited earlier than the ones at the top. So it means that by looking at that sequence, you can come up with a relative chronology or a relative ordering of events through time. So what Robinson and others did was that the period one material was at the bottom of the sequence. So that became the earliest, followed by period 2, 3, and 4. And also they looked at the chronology of stone walls that I will explain with the aid of photographs. And then they also used radiocarbon dating to give us this sequence of Great Zimbabwe. So all the other interpretations, they are anchored on this basic sequence, which was produced by Robinson. This is a schematic diagram which represents the chronology of the typology of ceramics from Great Zimbabwe. We don't need to poke ourselves into detail. This is just for illustrative purposes. So this is class one, which was found in period one. The designs are these oblique lines of comb stepping. And this is class two, which has these incisions. Then there is class three. Class three corresponds to period three. So that's also perhaps the beginning of gold working stone walls. And you can see three, it gave birth to three or four. And then there's also class four, which is associated with the fluorescence of Great Zimbabwe. And this is what is termed the class five, what came after AD 1550. So this is just a scheme from Keith Robinson's 1961 paper, which relates the types of pots to the evidence from the stratigraphy. I must also confess that this is pottery classification is also a very subjective exercise, such that the archaeologist Martin Hall once remarked that in archaeology or in Iron Age archaeology, the number of pottery classes that you get are equal to the number of archaeologists that are around. So each one of us will come up with their classification scheme. But I'm not saying that you should doubt this, in the sense that Keith Robinson combined multiple strands of evidence. He used this pottery seriation or pottery typology, combined that with stone walls, glass bead chronology. So the multiple layers of evidence are there, which at least makes some of us believe that he was spot on. This is my photograph. I'm not so sure how clearly visible it is from the back, but these are ceramics from Mapungubwe in the Shashlibombo, and these are the decorated ceramics from Grace Maru, just for interest's sake. And these ceramics, they do look very different, in the sense that Mapungubwe is dominated by these complex designs, and it also has some shapes which you don't find at Great Zimbabwe. The other point of difference between Mapungubwe ceramics and those from Great Zimbabwe is that 99% of the pots or the local pottery from Great Zimbabwe are not decorated at all. They are just plain, and then they are polished with graphite, that black pigment. And nothing else. So at least it's only 1% which is decorated. In contrast, at Mapungubwe is the reverse. About 99% are decorated with these complex designs. So it's these differences which are making people question the links between Great Zimbabwe and Mapungubwe. These groups of people may have been related. But why then are these differences in ceramics? That's something that I could comment on further, perhaps during the question time. But for the interest of progress, let me move on to something else. I mentioned the fact that Keith Robinson combined different layers of evidence. This is a section drawing of the trench that he established in the hill complex. So it started as a two meters by 1 meter trench, but at the end I think he had to reduce it because this whole top section, that's the deposit that I was saying was removed by earlier excavators. So it only started from this area. And according to this sequence here, you can see that this mainly relates to period 5, and then there's a bit of period 4, and then period 3, as well as period 2. You can also see that period 3 is perhaps the largest, according to Robinson. This is a drawing from Robinson's 1961 article, and these are the corresponding pottery glasses. And just again to remind ourselves, these are the pots again, as they were ordered by Robinson. So class 1 was at the bottom, followed by class 2, class 3, and so forth and so on. So again, it shows the fact that our understanding of Great Zimbabwe is now based on solid evidence. Well, these are numbers, and I'm sure you know what they say about statistics, damn statistics. So. But for illustrative purposes, this is just a sequence which was run in a program called OxCow, which is based at Oxford. Just to show you that on the basis of available dates, at least Great Zimbabwe was occupied, this is mainly period 2. So just after 1000 AD, that's when we see occupation. And it ends somewhere closer to 1500. But of course, this is limited by the fact that we don't have period 2 dates, and we also don't have some period 4 dates, so that's why we have this sequence. But if we are to believe it, then according to this model, it shows that occupation started somewhere around 602 and ended in 1529. So this date here is problematic because there are very few dates to define what is known as the boundary and the start of the sequence. But this 1529 date can be verified independently using Chinese blue on white porcelain, which was recovered from the valley enclosures. At least that gives us an idea that Great Zimbabwe was still occupied at some point in the early 16th century. Just for comparison's sake, you can also see that that's also the 1000 AD line is here. That's also around about the same time that Mapungubwe was occupied. We can ignore this part because that's outside the main settlement. But what is being indicated here is that perhaps Mapungubwe ended closer to 1400 AD and not around 1290 AD as the model that I presented to you earlier on. That is one of the reasons why people are questioning the validity of the climatic deterioration model in the rise of Great Zimbabwe, a stroke, a decline of Mapungubwe. Let me move on to another category of material culture that makes up a Great Zimbabwe. These are the stone walls. The architect Anon Witty studied the typology of these stone walls and came up with a sequence. After studying all the walls at Great Zimbabwe, Anon Witty concluded that the earliest conformed to what he called P. This P class simply means poorly caused walls. Sometimes the courses they do not run through. It's just stones are stacked nicely one on top of the other. As I mentioned, using the precise placement method. Over time, there was an improvement in workmanship, and there was this PQ wall. You can see that the courses are now a little bit elaborate. Some of them can run through. PQ was followed by what is known as the Q volume type that represents the pinnacle of the achievements of stone wall construction at Great Zimbabwe. You can nicely see these walls as they run through almost equal blocks, and they are Q type walls believed to be much later according to this classification scheme. And then after Q, there was a sort of a decline, if we may use that word, or a deterioration rather, in terms of workmanship, giving birth to this class R. So according to Anon Witty then, if we are to come up with the sequence of stone walls in Great Zimbabwe, we will see that class P, the poorly caused, were the first, then there was a PQ, a mixture of P and Q, and then there was these Q walls with R being the last. And this evidence can also be related to the ceramics and to the radiocarbon dates. And we have used this data to come up with new interpretations. So that was this is just a schematic representation. This is the reality on the ground. So this is one of the western wall on the hill complex. That's the site looking towards Masingo, Lake Kyle, or Fort Victoria as it was then. And you can see that these walls, they conform to Anon Witty's spee style. They form the majority of the walls on the hill complex. So this is much earlier when compared to other sections. And then there's this Q-style walling. Those of you familiar with the former Zimbabwe dollar, I mean the coin, not the, you know, not the paper. This is something that used to appear at the back. And that's the conical tower at Great Zimbabwe. As you can see, it's built in almost equal blocks, nicely coursed, and so forth. So this is a Q-type walling. So on the basis of this information then, if we are to order the development of Great Zimbabwe, we will say that stone wall construction started on the hill, and then it came to this area of the Great Enclosure, which has a Q-type of walls. And then these are what are known as R-type of walling, sometimes known as rough. And as you can see, they are not as elaborate as the P or Q or PQ. And it is believed that these were built towards the end, when the workmanship had deteriorated. And as I mentioned, this typology of stone walls is a chronological indicator. So this is just a map which gives us an idea of what is happening and where at Great Zimbabwe. You can see that the hill complex is mostly built in P. There is a little bit of PQ as well as Q. Here, these upper valley enclosures, they are exclusively built in P. So they are contemporary with most of the other hill. And then the great enclosure developed over time. It has elements of P, PQ, and Q. And these valley enclosures, they are exclusively built in Q style. And the evidence suggests that this was the last place to be built at Great Zimbabwe. So this is an expanding settlement, which from time to time, they were opening up new areas and building different sets of architecture. This is also very important in terms of the meanings. For example, who was living in the Great Enclosure, who was living in the hill complex, and who was living in the lower enclosures. Because some of the interpretations that we have, they have divided Great Zimbabwe into different spaces. The hill is associated with the king, and this great enclosure is associated with state functions, and this is where the king's wife are supposed to have been residing. But I will present that in detail tomorrow. But for us to be able to understand the reasoning behind it, we also should understand this development as far as architecture is concerned. And the radiocarbon data suggests that these parts with the P, they are earlier than those with P, Q, and Q. Not so sure what happens here. I think I now believe with George Orwell when he says that power corrupts, but power blind corrupts absolutely. Let me see. What was? Oh, okay. If we are to discuss the material culture of Great Zimbabwe, we will stumble upon the stone walls, which are indeed also an artifact. We will also encounter ceramics, objects made of gold, and so forth. But by just scrutinizing the architecture itself, what statements can we make? If people are making these walls, this is 11 meters high, and you can see this nice and elaborate chevron design, which also appear on other categories of material culture, such as some of these stone walled walls. This is a picture taken from Ezekiel, so I'm sure some of you may have seen it. So what can we say about the stone walls at Great Zimbabwe? There was also a question yesterday, what was the function of these stone walls? So the first issue is that these walls may have been built for reasons associated with prestige and power. The people who built them could command significant amounts of labor that were necessary to build this. Clearly, the amount of investment in the quarrying of the rock and in the dressing and building it, it's only people who had much authority in society who could achieve that. So that's why archaeologists think that these stone walls, they signify a prestige, and they also materialize an ideology of power. It separates the rulers from the ruled. Tom Huffman has also creatively come up with what he calls the concept of a sacred leadership. He argues that most of the kings, at least in the ethnographic record, they are very sacred people. Let's just go to a vendor, modern day vendor, and consider that we are to visit some of the modern day chiefs. The concept of sacred leadership will tell us that the chiefs, they, because they are considered to be sacred, they are separated from the rest of the population. So they live in their sanda, or in their compound. I hope it is a politically correct word. So we find that the chief amongst the vendor is associated with their own quarters or their own residence, and they are screened from the commoners. So that's the process of sacred leadership, and they are also, the chiefs are also believed to be important. So according to Tom Huffman then, these walls were built to materialize that ideology of sacred leadership, where the kings were very important and they could not be seen by the commoners. Hence the construction of all these stone walls. But the most interesting point is that this is at the back, and that's the highest point. The front is not as high as this. And in some cases, you find that chiefs who were living in areas and the stone walls were very low. But nevertheless, it is argued that it's the principle which is very important, the idea of seclusion. You want to separate your leaders from their followers, so you have to build stone walls for them. Whether we believe in that or not, at least that's an option which is on the table. There's also a whole range of material culture which was carved in soapstone, the provenance of which we don't know. And those objects include these soapstone walls. They are quite big. This is more than 30 centimeters. Some are probably, 60 centimeters in terms of the internal diameter. And it is believed that about 32 soapstone bowls were recovered at Great Zimbabwe. And they come with different sets of iconography. What animal could this be? Those who are closer enough to see. What animal could this be?
Leopards. Wow.
Leopards, baboon?
Yeah.
Which is which? Leopard here?
Yeah.
Baboon?
Yeah.
This one? Yeah. And here? Yeah. Well, whatever that is, but the iconography here, it just, it's difficult to decipher what this means. But animals such as leopards, they are associated with power. I'm not so sure about baboons. So one of the commentary is actually, somebody was saying that this looks like a zebra. I don't know. Can see these stripes here. Somebody was saying that this looks like a zebra, which means that it's probably somebody who loved nature like we do today, and then said, well, I'm carving my bowl, how about if I put all these animals, which are my favorite? But we know that, of course, art is never simplistic. So it is difficult to understand the meaning behind this iconography. There are some animals which we can try and understand with the aid of the ethnography, for example, the leopard and power. And the interpretation is that these are bowls which have been used for a ceremonial, for religious, or for symbolic purposes. They are quite heavy, such that it is difficult to believe that they would have been used for serving food on a day-to-day basis. And also, it's not many of them. Let's not forget about their cousins. By their cousins, I mean those eight soapstone beds which were recovered from Great Zimbabwe. Seven of them from the Hill Complex, and one from the valley. I think I had one towards the at the beginning of my talk yesterday. Wow, that's a long way. This one. So this is this one was recovered from the postal ruins here in the valley. There were eight of these soapstone beds. One of them was one of them ended up in Berlin, but it has now been returned back to Zimbabwe. The most interesting thing about the designs on these beds is that we can clearly see here this design, which appear on the walls of the Great Enclosure. And there's this guy here. What is this? Oh, one of those guys that ran away from that farm in Limpopo. I would be terrified to walk around in that. It's just so many of them. So if we go to the ethnography again, we realize that the crocodile is associated with power. Amongst the vendor, the chief is referred to as a crocodile in a pool. So this iconography, again, we can link it to power, and the same applies to those designs that appear on the soapstone above. So the conclusion that we can make then is we see that the people at Great Zimbabwe, they were designing or decorating their material culture in a similar designs, which should not be surprising, because it's the same group of people who also share the same worldview, and a worldview incorporates beliefs and so on. So just to emphasize the point that the designs that we find on this material culture, together with that which appears on the beds and on the stone walls, it just shows that it was built by the same group of people, and it's all to do with iconography of power. Away from stone walls and soapstone beds, there are also these objects. This is a composite, which is very thin and delicate wire of made of copper, and this is mostly iron. So that's the full size there. And it is believed that these objects would have been used as expressive objects to showcase the power of the rulers. Some metallurgists performed some studies, metallographic studies on one of these objects, and found that the metal was very, very, very thin, indicating that they had no utilitarian value. So that's one of the reasons why we tend to believe that these objects were associated with the power of the kings. And indeed, this was also found on the hill complex, one place which is believed to have been at the seat of the king. This is yet again a wide array of objects. This is a bronze bowl, probably 2 millimeters thick, so clearly it would not have had a utilitarian function. This is another bronze one. These are also made of bronze, and you can also see, because of these designs here, these would not have been used. So the thinking is that they are used for ceremonial purposes, and indeed, we can again go into the ethnography. We see many chiefs. They do have as insignia of their office spears, noble carries, and so on and so forth. So we can draw from that ethnography to say that these items would have been used as expressive objects. Of course, we should also be mindful of the fact that if we rely too much on the ethnography, then sometimes nothing changes. In other words, the past becomes the present, because we will be seeing everything that is around us and translating that into the past. So we should always try to run away from those limitations. But nevertheless, the ethnography is a very useful piece of evidence. Then there is this object here. Can anybody guess what it is? Which one can fit it in here, isn't it? Ingots, made of copper, stylistically, the most interesting thing is that these are types of idols. They were made from the north of, they were made in the northern side of the Zambezi River. So that's at the other side in Zambia. And they were principal form in which copper was exchanged in the modern day copper belt area. So starting from Katanga in the Democratic People's Republic of Congo, coming back to Zambia, as well as maybe extending to some parts of of northern Zimbabwe. There is an archaeological site called Ingombe Ilele, which is on the margins of the Zambezi River, where these ingots were found. So most ingots are found on the Zimbabwe Plateau and adjacent regions in South Africa and Botswana. The shape is not like this. It's more of a proper X. If there was that old chalkboard, then I would have tried to impress you with my artistic skills. But unfortunately, I cannot do that. So the presence of this so-called Katanga ingot at Great Zimbabwe has been used as evidence of trade and exchange relationships between these parts of the world. So it is believed that Great Zimbabwe would or had trading contacts with communities at least across the Zambezi River who were bringing in this copper. There are also, I think about 8 iron gongs, like the ones which are currently they are used in, they are mostly found in West Africa, those iron gongs. If I remember tomorrow, I will try and show you one photograph, which again were made across the Zambezi. So the combination of these ingots and those iron gongs does provide strong evidence that Great Zimbabwe had very strong connections based on trade with communities that were living in other parts of southern Africa. And one may want to ask, what was the nature of craft production at Great Zimbabwe? There's evidence of weaving. They are what are known as spindle walls or discs, ceramic discs, which are with a hole in the middle, which were used as flywheels in the spinning of indigenous cotton. Many of them were recovered at Great Zimbabwe. Production, though, most of the production seemed to have taken place in the hinterland. If we believe the estimate that Great Zimbabwe had 20,000 people, then it would have needed a lot of metal. It would also have needed a lot of other raw materials. But in comparison, the production debris is very, very minimal, giving a weight to the thinking that most of the production was done in the villages where the bulk of the population lived. I talked about exotic imports which were recovered at the Great Zimbabwe. These are just photographs, perhaps in chronological order, of the beads that were recovered at Great Zimbabwe. These are what are known as Azizo beads. Chemically, they were produced in Indonesia, and they are followed by K2 series, and these are Indo-Pacific. Then there are what are known as the Mapungubwe series, as well as the Great Zimbabwe series. One of the topical questions that we are having at the moment is that are these glass beads different from your point of view? Of course, I'm very biased. But can we say that they are the same or they are different? Of course, I say here, this one and this one, the Mapungubwe series, these two rows, the Great Zimbabwe series. But if I had not written Mapungubwe and Great Zimbabwe, would you have separated them? So that's one of the major questions that in terms of these. So this classification is meant to support the thinking that we start from Mapungubwe and then we get on to Great Zimbabwe and then we move on to Ghana. But the evidence from material culture does suggest otherwise, that these are places perhaps they could have been contemporary or overlapping. Even the geochemical evidence strontium isotopes and the other heavy rare earths elements, they are also not conclusive. They are closely similar. But at least we are archaeologists, so let's say these are Mapungubwe and these are Great Zimbabwe, and these were followed by Kamibits. You can also see some points of resemblance between the Great Zimbabwe and the Kamibits. So the picture is a little bit messy, but what we can say is that the beads, following stratigraphic evidence, they grade into these distinctions, and archaeologists have also angered the chronology of the site based on this. And more importantly, glass beads are believed to be prestige objects. Great Zimbabwe was, thousands of glass beads were recovered at Great Zimbabwe. It is believed that it was an important redistribution center. Those in power could redistribute it and use it to their strategic advantage. Then there is this blue on white porcelain, which came from China, specifically it dates to the Ming Dynasty, which is after AD 1868. And the chemistry of this has been tied to that of producer regions in China. And this dates to just after 1500. So that's further confirmation of the fact that Great Zimbabwe was at least occupied, though maybe on a smaller scale, in the early 16th century, although the Portuguese, who were on the East African coast, did not say much about it. So we can see that Great Zimbabwe played an important role in the activities that were taking place at the Indian Ocean during this time. If we, however, get into numbers, then we might have a different opinion. No less than, I think the total number of these imported ceramics, irrespective of how many vessels they make. By vessels, I mean, if we take these fragments and try to piece them together, how many complete vessels can we come up with? Just counting the fragments one by one, there are not more than 90 pieces from Great Zimbabwe, from the start of its occupation up to its abandonment. So the question is, how important were these ceramics? If maybe one can also say that the fact that we have so few of them also means that perhaps they had a high value. But Peter Hart-Gallick has tried to argue that, well, perhaps we should look at more at local material culture, because that formed the bulk. I can say that it's neither here nor there. This perhaps is the start of tomorrow's lecture. As such, I would like to invite questions and points that need clarification or elaboration. Yes.
Chinese
structure
was brought in by traders from China.
Yes. You know the story of the Chinese giraffe?
Chinese what?
Giraffe. Okay. The story goes like this. There was a great Chinese explorer. I'm sure you are aware of that the Chinese, they've started a new research project in Kenya, specifically in the Lamu Archipelago. So the legend has it that the Emperor of China sent his best explorers to East Africa. They met some of those sultans of the Swahili towns, and one of those sultans then gave a giraffe to the Emperor of China, and the giraffe was sent to China. Whether it reached there or not, that's another thing. But the short answer to your question is yes, they would have depended on intermediaries, so traders from China to the East African coast, and then what are known as the Moors or the Arabs would then take the merchandise into the interior. Those were the guys who were displaced by the Portuguese when they settled on the East African coast. So middlewomen. We have to begin. Yes.
How do you know about the language? What are
Yes.
Linked to Shona language.
Yes.
What type of artifacts invasion of?
One of them is called speculation. And the other one is, you see, archaeologists are very clever people. Let me tell you what. Let me answer your question with the use of this object here. Designs. It starts like this. If we are one group of people, we share the same worldview. Do you agree? The way we see the world generally is the same. So it also means that the objects that we make, the way we decorate them, it also should be the same, isn't it? So based on the same logic, these designs that you find on these objects, such as soapstone bowls, the objects that you also find on the ceramics, even though it's 1% that is decorated in Great Zimbabwe, it has convinced archaeologists that it was built by Karanga people. And also, though of course there are some limitations, the Karanga people, they are occupying that area even up to today. So we are assuming that maybe there was no movement. So those are the reasons that I can think of why archaeologists have been that Great Zimbabwe is an ancient Karanga settlement. Yes?
You gave the dates of the Kani complexes, 1450 to 1820.
Did I?
And my question is, did Europeans view those settlements before they went to ruins?
Sorry?
Did Europeans, since it was 1820, were Europeans in Zimbabwe in that area?
Ah, yes. Kami is very interesting in the sense that there is what is known as the Portuguese cross on one smaller ruin associated with Kami, what is known as the cross ruin. So the cross, we know, is a symbol of Christianity, and Christianity was associated with the Portuguese. After 1450, let's say 1600, in fact, the collapse of Kami in 1650 is recorded in Portuguese documents that there was a Portuguese garrison that was sent from Sena to try and fight the people who were living at Kami over the control of gold production. So that area in modern day Bulawayo is very rich in gold. So Kami was dominating that trade, and the Portuguese wanted the trade. There are also evidence of what is known as chalk on white porcelain. So rather than blue on white, but chocolate on white, and that was brought by the Portuguese, we know for sure. And that has also been recovered at Kami. So, yes?
Who facilitated the trade between Great Zimbabwe and the coast? Was it Swahilis?
Your guess can be as good as mine's there.
But the didn't know of each other.
Yeah. So, the very, very few reports, written documents that are there, they suggest that the Swahili traders would move from the coast into the interior. And also some local people would also move from the interior to the coast. There is a report that appears in the journal of Karl Malk, which talks about his activities around 1871. He mentions that young men of marriageable age, they could go to the coast in search of glass beads to give to the women which they were going to get married. So from that piece of information, we can say that there were people coming in from the coast, and there were also people coming from the interior to the coast. And they were also what we may call the modern version of pirates, because in that same journal, Karl Mauch talks about the fact that most people would come from the coast and they were robbed of their possessions and so on. So it was just a mixture. But of course, it's complicated by the fact that we don't know for sure. So we can just leave maybe 1 or 2 degrees of freedom. How are we doing in terms of time? Okay, let's start here.
Today's beautiful sculptures which one can view, in fact, the same around the peninsula. Do the people who
that's a very interesting question, but I'm afraid no. The history of stone sculpture in Zimbabwe, it is associated, some of you may know, what was his name? Tom Blomfield, Stengenenge Art Village, associated with those master sculptures like Isaac Takawira, Joram Kumbo. If some of us have been to Atlanta, Hartsfield International Airport, there are those, there's that Shona Sculpture Gallery, where you have those master, the artists, I mean, those artists' work is being displayed there. So the legend is that that stone sculpture was started by some migrant from Angola who colluded with Tom Blomfield, and they started Tengenenge. And because of the success of that enterprise, it's now all over. So there is indeed a break from the soapstones of Great Zimbabwe until the present.